I do definitely need the water, because I'm just going to briefly send you a photo of the temperature sensor on the front of my fan.
See, my cold open joke got me a free book. Thank you very much to listener Bridget, who I had said I'd pay postage for 3 Tilda Thompson novels, and she very kindly waived it because it was a good joke. Oh, thank you, Bridget. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the very 105th episode of Octothorpe. This episode is coming to you on the 14th of March, 2024. I'm John Coxon.
I'm Alison Scott.
And I'm Liz Betty.
We heard from some people.
Andrew wrote us a long, interesting letter about the Hugo controversy, which we're going to cover later when we talk about the Hugo controversy. And meanwhile, she says she liked my Greg Wallace reference, so there.
It was a good Greg Wallace reference once you had explained it to me and Liz, both of whom had no idea about Greg Wallace.
But who have now been sending me Greg Wallace memes for 4 weeks, so you know.
Oh yeah, now we know about Greg Wallace. Like, now we're clued in.
This is maybe the only time I understand a popular culture meme before either of you two do, so I'm milking it.
We also got a letter from Andy Openshaw saying, why is no one talking about a murder at the end of the world? I thought that was canny good and deserves to be in contention. I did think about a murder at the end of the world, but the ending is rubbish. I mean, I think it is science fiction, but it's not at all interesting for its science fictional elements. It could be, but I think it kind of has too many flaws to really be interesting.
An example of this, I think, is the... There was a show called The Resort in 2022, which was great and had genre elements, but kind of ended on a damp squib. And I think that was a similar thing where I would have loved to nominate it, but ultimately I just felt like it didn't quite stick the landing in a way that made it feel fulfilling. And so like this can be a problem with limited SF shows. So it's sad when it happens.
Yeah, I mean, I should say it's all about kind of, you know, the end of the world they're in is kind of a tech billionaire's Icelandic hideout against climate change. And it's got that kind of, it is, you know, 10 seconds in the future thing going on. But then in the end, I don't think it says anything super interesting about it. And I had figured out the murder too early. It's all right, though.
But I had never even heard of it, so thanks for the recommendation.
And Andy also messaged me on Saturday when we were both doing our Hugo nominations. He messaged me asking why some things are listed in the long form tab of the Hugo spreadsheet of doom and some things are listed in the short form. And he was like, why does that happen? And I basically told him that it's whatever people reckoned they wanted to put on whichever tab. There's no unified mind behind it. And so it kind of gives you a clue as to where people are thinking of nominating things. But yeah, there's not much more order than that. When did you do your Hugo nominations, peeps?
A couple of weeks ago.
So I did get up yesterday morning, this was Saturday, thinking, oh, I should probably nominate for the Hugos today. Let me check when the deadline is. And then I got involved in many other things. And then I remembered again, and at that point it was 12 minutes past three. The deadline was 4 o'clock, and I was like, whoops, I hope the website isn't going down. But in fact, the website seemed very resilient and was having no problems with people who left it to the last minute, no doubt because there weren't very many of us and everyone else had done it in good time. But I did it at 3:15, and I was not the only one on our Discord server who had done it at 3:15, so there we go. And Stephen didn't do it till 3:45, and I was then like, who should I nominate? Do you have any ideas? We made a list in the last Octothorpe. Go look at that.
So Chris also speaks about the same mysterious thing that Ange spoke of. So we will talk about that later. But he also says, Paul Durr isn't Zodiac. My dad would have known Durr, and it's quite possible I met him in my very young years. Neither of us were murdered, so it can't be him. Thanks for writing in, Chris. What I love is Chris can drop names in any situation. You need a name drop. Chris Garcia's your guy. Spacecraft, Chris Garcia. Serial killer, Chris Garcia. Anyone else in the world, Chris Garcia.
Old computers,
Chris Garcia. He also apparently does a podcast about Zodiac called Zodiac Speaking, and we will put a link in the show notes.
What Chris does?
Because of course he does. Chris Garcia, Renaissance man.
Chris does everything.
If Zodiac does turn out to be Paul Dirt, Chris, that podcast is technically eligible for Fancast. Ursets Culture and Raj had a chat in our Mastodon mentions in which they note that City Last Chances was published in the US in December 2022 as a simultaneous ebook release. So it is not, in fact, eligible. We regret the error.
Oh, shit, I've nominated it. Should have nominated the second one.
Ersatz Culture wrote to say Children of Memory is actually eligible because it only became available in the States in January 2023. So yes, thank you. That was too late for us to include it before nominations shut. Hopefully no one got themselves in a knot with that information.
Martin Easterbrook writes to say, for Scholars of the Constitution, do we have any Scholars of the Constitution in the house? At what point does someone officially become a Hugo winner? This is like at what point somebody is officially. This is like at what point does somebody become king, and the use of, kings to impart messages over vast distance, because they have the divine right of kings once they're kings. So if you keep a supply of kings and kill one on the home planet, then you can impart a message by, because the person on the heir on the far planet is now king, and so has the divine right of kings, and so can do king things. And so thereby you know that something has happened. But anyway, at what point does somebody officially become Hugo winner? And I assume it is at the point where their name is read out on stage.
I'm going to say, I think this is the sort of question that arises from hanging out in the Wussfuss business meeting Discord. I think it's when they win a Hugo.
When their name is read out on stage. Because he's got the name, he's got the word officially in his thing.
What's the counter argument to it being that? What are the options?
We know that La La Land's name was read out on stage and did not win Best Picture Oscar because they gave him the wrong envelope. So what if we gave someone the wrong envelope?
Yes, but the Hugos would never make a mistake like that.
Would we then just have to declare that was the winner? Because that seems like maybe a not great system.
Okay, I'll amend this. At the point at which the correct winner is read out on stage, will that do?
On the subject of another thing Martin Easterbrook wrote, he asked in a previous episode, you know, whether or not, basically, he argued that this had happened before at Western World Cons. Sorry. The thing that happened at Chengdu with it being slowly taken over by a group outside of fandom had happened before at Western World Cons, and, like, no one was really talking about that. And Hispania Serif sent in a link to a discussion of the 1987 World Science Fiction Convention in which the Scientologists tried to steal World Con. And if you read this article, I think it becomes very clear that people did have extremely strong opinions about this. And those extremely strong opinions were no, no, no. So I think when this happened in the UK, people were also hopping mad.
Oh, yeah, no, they were apoplectic. And I was there at the time. And as if you read the article that Hispania links to, it wasn't quite they were trying to take over the Worldcon. They were trying to get undue influence and sponsorship. This is more closer to the Raytheon thing. And because the Worldcon was very short of money, and this is a problem with the way that Worldcons are sometimes very short of money, they made some decisions that they absolutely should not have made. But they didn't realise how bad it was going to be until it had happened. And, you know, there were other things about that Worldcon. It was my first Worldcon. I was so excited.
Hey!
I spent the entire time being in an advanced state of excitement.
We also heard from Tammy Coxon, who we kind of called out last episode for saying that Worldcon is dying. And I thought she left us a very reasonable comment saying, you know, fair enough for calling it out, which is, if nothing else, it's a very nice way of doing the discourse in which we don't get annoyed with each other. We just have a conversation. And she does say, yes, she thinks she's seeing a lot of enthusiasm maybe coming out of Europe and maybe less out of other places. And yet that it's just really, really hard to run a Worldcon right now. And she has chaired a Worldcon and can't imagine. Sorry, she used to want to chair a Worldcon. She has chaired a NASFIC and can't imagine doing it again. I mean, I can't imagine chairing a Worldcon, but fortunately we seem to have enough people who do want to do that it's working at the moment. And I too hope that maybe the current Hugo thing will lead to some productive changes that will help motivate more people to want to run Worldcons. So thank you, Tammy.
I'd agree with that.
But yeah, thank you very much for leaving a comment, Tammy, and being very gracious about us. I want to say one thing. I want to pick up one thing from the comment, which is She says, I'm not a business meeting fan, and I'd love to figure out a way for us to run the organization more fairly in a way that makes running WorldCon something more people want to do. I think there are a lot of people who try to intersect with running the WorldCon at a high level, and they intersect with the business meeting and they're like, oh no, I cannot do this. I think there is a conversation we need to have about the fact that the business meeting massively enforces the group of people who work on the WorldCon and massively puts off the people who currently don't. And so if we're going to have this conversation, we need to have a serious conversation about what the business meeting does to people who might want to get involved, because I think it puts a lot of people off.
I have thinks here, and the main one is that the vast majority of people who work on WorldCons, including working on WorldCons at high level, aren't really very involved in the business meeting. They'll kind of go along to present their bid and to accept if they win, but only a very small proportion of WorldCon runners have anything to do with the business meeting.
Yes.
And the vast majority of people who work on WorldCons think the business meeting is just as mad as everybody else does. The only people who don't think the business meeting is mad is the set of people who like the business meeting, which is quite a small set of people.
Yes, I completely agree with everything you've just said. But I think if you want to get involved with running the WorldCon, naively, a lot of people who don't really know how it works go to the business meeting because they're like, this is where the decisions are made. And I think that belies the fact that most of the decisions are actually made in committee. But I don't think that's transparent to new members at all. And so I think you have this core of people who would quite like to be involved in the WorldCon at quite a high level. And the business meeting is basically this giant, distracting put-off.
Agreed. If you want to get involved in running WorldCons, including getting involved at a high level, so what you do is you email volunteers@glasgow2024.org and they'll give you a little job to do, and then you'll find that people resign above you as things go terribly wrong, and then suddenly you'll be working on the WorldCon at a high level. That's how it works.
Would that it were not so.
But honestly, if you want to get involved in running WorldCons at a high level, that is my top tip. It will work. Sorry, Esther.
I've got nothing to say about business meetings because I think we've really covered that ground before, and we shouldn't do it again unless we have something new to discuss.
Fair.
We definitely will sometime, but maybe not today. Sandra Bond wrote to us. We did get a lot of letters this week and said...
It's because we haven't recorded for a month.
Oh, we should record every 2 weeks, shouldn't we? Except when we don't. I finally caught up with you once again while driving around after Corfu and nearly swerved off the road into a New Mexico canyon when I heard you once again plug me for a Hugo nomination. Okay, so we have a kind of listener's advice here, which is if the contents of the audio you are listening to while driving might make you swerve, don't listen to it while driving. Listen to stuff that won't make you swerve. Seriously.
Well, this is partly my fault because I do the trigger warnings in the show notes and it didn't occur to me to put this as a trigger, but it probably is one. So we will endeavour to be better about it in future, Sandra. But no, and not only did we plug Sandra, I nominated Sandra on Saturday. Boom.
Other thing else, Sandra also says, perhaps you could find a few seconds to plug my first collection of verse, Poetry Slum, due out at EasterCon. I did my Kipling pastiche about Dave McCarty won't be in it, so you'll have to wait for her second collection of poetry if you want to read that. And she has sent us the covers, which we'll put in the chapter art.
Yes, we will link it somewhere.
And I was wondering whether I might, to whet everybody's appetite, read out the poem from the back, from the blurb that give her the title for this. If you want to score Sestinas or a baggie of blank verse, you can buy them on the darknet. Then again, you could do worse. Then slip down to the sleazy spot where the versifiers come and speak to the suppliers down in the poetry slum.
I do like Sandra.
I like Sandra, and I like Sandra's poetry a whole lot. A lot of her poetry is really good.
Finally, bring us home, Liz.
Actually, we got two more because I missed one. We heard from Murphy's Lawyer on Blue Sky. We're on Blue Sky. I'm trying to be actually doing stuff on Blue Sky, by the way.
That's Harry Payne.
Harry Payne, who has been sideloading our podcasts onto their e-reader. So there's a picture of like Octothorpe with the logo in black and white on a Kobo. I didn't even know you can do that, but it's quite impressive. It might be easier just to like put my new phone. if anyone is out there listening to Octothorpe on a fridge or a toaster or a, you know, 1983 Unix workstation, please drop us a line.
I was going to say, if you're listening to Octothorpe on a pregnancy test, please let us know.
Nicholas Jackson also sent a message on Blue Sky, say the discussion of Hugo, popes, cardinals, etc. reminded him of a costume from the Masquerade at EasterCon 1999, which is Andrew Patterson as St. Hugo of Fandom. And he sent a picture of St. Hugo of Fandom. So we'll put that in the show notes for you all.
Thank you very much, Nicholas.
Anyway, that was letters. Way, letters.
Letters of comment. Boom. Commented. Now let's look at the BSFA Awards shortlist. Dun, 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 dun. We have questions. I've not discussed this with my fellow co-hosts, but I feel confident that we have questions. Do you guys have questions?
Oh, about the BSFA shortlist.
Yes. So one thing we should say is, I believe from the long list, Best Translated Short Fiction did not get a lot of submissions, and they have transitioned it to being a juried award. I don't know whether this is permanent, or whether this is just this year, or what exactly the deal is, but it has definitely happened.
When it says this award is selected by an appointed BSFA jury, does that mean the shortlists are selected by a jury, or the voting, like the whole thing is done by a jury? Because a juried shortlist with a public vote sounds pretty good.
I don't know.
If I click on the voting form in my email from the BSFA, I can see if I can vote for it or not, right?
Yes. You have to bear in mind that neither me nor Liz got that voting form.
Because you're not BSFA members.
Yes, indeed.
Right. No, I am not being given an option to vote on it. So it is a juried award.
Whee! Thank you for finding that out, Alison.
I will note that Best Short Fiction is now things which are shorter than Best Shorter Fiction. I don't know. I still find that a little bit confusing.
So shorter fictions like novellas and novelettes.
Yeah.
And then short fiction is shorter fiction than shorter fiction. It's shorterer.
Yeah.
And then you have Best Non-Fiction Short and Best Non-Fiction Long, because they've changed it. I noticed when I first looked at this page, they were not templated similarly, and I was a bit like, come on, guys. But they've changed it, so they are. So that's good. Good BSFA. Shall we stop talking about our annoyances about quibbly little pedantic things and talk about the actual works?
Well, I mean, the reason I'm talking about this is because I actually am not familiar with most of the works, right? So
one of the things that was noticed when this went up, which is the under Best Shorter Fiction, which is for fiction that's longer than short fiction, the Book of Gaheris was listed by Carrie Spering as one of the nominees, but that has been replaced with Knotted Thorn, which is one of the stories from the Book of Gaheris, which is good because Knotted Thorn is eligible, and as far as I understood it, the full book was not. But I think that was probably just an error by the BSFA. It does look like they've gone through and fixed some of the mistakes, which is really nice, because the first version of this shortlist, they had not, and it is good that they have.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to call out that I actually haven't read any of the novels, unusually, but in Best Nonfiction Long, we do have the collections of essays by Neil Harrison, All These Worlds, and A Travel in Time, The Critical Practice of Maureen Kincaid's Bella, which we suggested for the Hugo nominations a few weeks ago. And there's also quite a lot of interesting stuff in the Best Nonfiction Short category. Like, there's a interesting-looking set of essays there with everything from Fiona Moore's Project Management Lessons from Rogue One, but also there's one about the burden of writing from the margins. There's one about dominant themes in Afrocentric fiction by Eugene Bacon. It looks like a really strong shortlist, although I've not read all of them yet. And it's nice that the BSFA continued to kind of recognise that, because I know there was a while where the BSFA Best Non-Fiction, I think there were a few years where it wasn't awarded, or then it became juried and so on. But it does seem like now there's enough people reading and nominating things to justify having two categories for this, which is pretty nice.
Yeah, no, it looks like a vibrant shortlist.
And you can vote on the shortlist if you are a member of the BSFA or a member of EasterCon Levitation. It actually says attendees of the convention Levitation 2024, but I assume it actually means anyone who's got a membership in Levitation, not really people who turn up on site.
So historically, it was paper ballots at the EasterCon, but I assume they'll have a mechanism for people to vote online, because otherwise that would be a bit mad, wouldn't it?
I'm pretty sure you couldn't even paper ballot last time I did it. I just had to log in and do it on my phone at EasterCon. I hope so, because if I ever, I'm thinking about a virtual membership to Levitation, partly so I can also vote in the Beer Survey Awards. So if I don't get a vote, then it takes away a little bit of the value of my virtual membership. And also seems a bit weird that I don't get a vote because I am geographically too far away and cannot make the EasterCon.
EasterCon!
Yes.
We're excited about EasterCon. Levitation.
I am excited about EasterCon, which is Levitation in Telford. It is not too late for you to join. And also, if you don't fancy getting to Telford, there's a virtual membership at a full virtual convention. I'm going to say much like we had last year, but I think they're using a slightly different system for that. Social events will be happening on a Discord, and there's going to be, I don't think we've announced them yet, but I think I'm going to say, so that people are excited about it, that there are going to be some social events in advance on Discord.
Ooh.
So that you can hang out with people, and if you haven't been to an EasterCon, see what it's like and talk to people about it and make plans for Telford and so on. They'll be happening in the week before Easter, but just in case, because I think if there is another episode of Octothorpe, so the next episode of Octothorpe will be Maundy Thursday, so it'll be before then, so I'm mentioning them now even though they're not announced yet, but they'll be happening the week before Easter, so that you can get used to Discord, make sure you're logged into Discord before the convention so that we don't have to sort it all out on Maundy Thursday. And by we, I don't really mean me, I mean Andrew and Emily and other people like that, and maybe me a bit. And then, John, are you doing anything at EasterCon?
I'm running the newsletter.
I'm excited about EasterCon. I'm also a bit sad because I will not be at EasterCon. I will be watching from afar. But on the other hand, that means I also won't be on a rail replacement bus to Telford. So I have made some good choices in life.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Enjoy listening to Octothorpe on Maundy Thursday while you're on the rail replacement bus, everyone.
Yeah, so there's been some sort of landslide between Shrewsbury and Telford.
I think they call it a landslip because that sounds less alarming.
There's been a geophysical buggery in between Telford and other places. The report I saw from National Rail basically said they are trying to clear it up before the 31st, which does firstly mean that it might get done before, but also means it might not. If you're planning to travel by train, be aware.
Now, there are trains to Telford. They're just doing rail replacement at the weekends. There probably will be a rail replacement on Good Friday and Easter Monday. I think they had already announced there weren't going to be trains those days. But I think you might be all right on Maundy Thursday. I don't want to guarantee it, though.
Alison will stake her reputation on it.
There was a report on this that confused two things, which was that there was rail replacement services over the weekend because it was a weekend, but also the landslip, which has affected the trains, but not to the point that they're not running.
I will say that last time there was a landslip and it was affecting the trains, I went to the station and they said, oh yeah, it'll be fine. It'll go a bit slower through the landslip bit, but you should be fine. I got all my money back for that train journey, and the conductor even gave us free crisps because we were stuck for so long. So, yeah.
I now do have an ordered list of games which I will buy if I ever get delay repay for anything.
The Coxon technique. It's probably my best achievement, which, given I have like a PhD thesis, bit conflicting.
Shall we discuss the Hugos?
Yes.
Now, I know we don't really talk about the Hugos very much on this podcast. In fact, I think we talk about them so much I've made that joke before, haven't I? So, we pre-recorded the last episode because we knew we needed to do it and get it out before the Hugo nomination deadline, which meant we have not commented on several new aspects of the 2023 Hugo ever-evolving big clusterfuck thing. The main thing that was reported was a big report from Chris Barkley and Jason Sanford, which I'm going to say is a pretty long report and covers quite a lot of stuff, but the main thing in it is they managed to get some emails which were released by Diane Lacey, who was on the Hugo administration team for Chengdu, which essentially show exactly what was going on during some bits of the Hugo process. So they released these emails, and these emails basically show a couple of things. One, they show Dave McCarty emailing his team and saying, When you are reviewing the nominees, don't just review them for technical eligibility. Please highlight anything of a sensitive political nature, that being defined as work focusing on China, Taiwan, Tibet, or other topics that may be an issue in China, which is basically a very broad slate, isn't it? And then there's a few more emails that basically discuss exactly what they were finding in some of the Hugo finalists.
I think dossiers. There are dossiers.
So there are two things. So there are these emails from Diane Lacey, which are basically they were going through trying to, like, say what might be issues with some of the potential finalists. And they released, for instance, the big one about, like, fan writer, which has a lot of really random things like Alistair Stewart wants to go to a Batman hotel in Taiwan. Blog reviews that mention China, you know, shares a bunch of news about it. The thing that really pulled this up is it's just basically like doing some Googling, but doing some Googling incompetently. For instance, they said that Paul Weimer, who was removed from the final ballot, travelled to Tibet and tweeted pictures and talked about food, but he hadn't been to Tibet. And yet they also missed other finalists who had been to Tibet. And the other thing that came out of this is there's a nomination spreadsheet. It's called Validation. And it basically is where they were doing these validation things and writing, you know, known issues, possible issues, minor issues or whatever. But what it also shows is that this is presumably the raw output of the first run of E Pluribus Hugo. And there's a bunch of items on there which were not on the final ballot. And if you look at the emails that were sent between Dave as well, it also says, and I'm going to just find this in quote, "Tomorrow I have a 4-hour meeting with my China counterpart to look at ballot detail and determine if any ballots are to be voided, which happens with frequency, so it's not really that controversial if we determine we need to do it." Yeah. So it's also clear that they voided a bunch of ballots, basically saying that there was some kind of slate voting going on, which appears to just be have been people voting for the same things off a nomination list, although it is quite complicated. It may not be exactly that, but that's what we have to assume. And then they reran the EPH and got a new set of finalists. And if you look at this, you know, spreadsheet called Validation, I think it's clear that there are like a couple of different runs of EPH on it. Some after they had pulled out a bunch of ballots, and then a few extra things get on. And then there's also this mysterious thing called the invitation list, which appears to be things they were going to check because they thought they might end up on the finalist list, but they're not under the first run of EPH. So I assume most of you have seen this at this point, but basically what we can say is they did extremely incompetent, weird vetting to try and find political issues and then seemed to slightly randomly remove people who had said something about something that might be controversial, but also that they just basically threw out a bunch of ballots.
And that's a large bunch of ballots, to be clear. Maybe most of them. I wanted to just mention a couple of other things that are just old history now, but probably in case our listeners don't know. Kat Jones, who had previously told me that she was involved only at a very early stage with the Hugo eligibility process, but was at the time the Hugo administrator for Glasgow, turned out to be one of the people who compiled these sets of information about possible candidates. And she has now resigned from her post at Glasgow, as has everybody else who has had anything to do with this. And Glasgow has a whole new Hugo team.
Good.
Under Nicholas White, who has also written a blog post, which we will link to, saying, "Actually, I really didn't have anything to do with this. And I did try to volunteer for China, but never heard anything back. Seemed to have dodged a bullet there." I may be paraphrasing there, but goes on to say a little bit about his philosophy in running Hugo's, which will not be a surprise to anyone who's worked with Nicholas on anything to do with this. So I think that's a good post that's useful from Nicholas, and hopefully everything is fine for this year's Hugo administration. And Glasgow has been very careful to make it straightforward for Chinese nominators to nominate in this year's Hugos, which of course they can do as members of Chengdu.
I speculated many moons ago that the reason that we hadn't seen the fan writer or fanzine part of the Hugo packet was because there was some snafu with it at a Chinese censorship level. And this very much supports that theory. So there were people at the time who were not convinced that that was a fair take, but it turns out that it was. We all wanted to be optimistic about the Chengdu Worldcom, but there was evidence that it was going weird quite early on, that I think no one really wanted to believe was true and has tragically turned out to be very true, which is frustrating. I can't believe that Cat Jones didn't immediately disclaim all of this as soon as the discourse started. Like, I don't understand how she didn't expect it to come out. Like, I would have just been like, yes. Because if you had apologised, if you had come clean and apologised at the point the stats dropped, you'd still be the Hugo administrator. Like, or at the very least, you wouldn't be, or at the very least, you wouldn't be persona non grata forever. But at this point, if Cat Jones is ever on a Worldcon committee again, or like a Worldcon team again, I will be extremely angry. And I think there was a way to manage that that would have made me much less angry.
I'm not sure that's fair, because it's clear that what she did was do the work and then have second thoughts. And, you know, people make mistakes. She made a couple of mistakes, actually. So doing the work was a mistake. But then also, when it started to come to light, she was kind of, how dare Diane release these emails, rather than Diane Lacey, let's be clear here, was completely correct to release these emails. It was absolutely the right thing to do.
It's never too late to start making good decisions.
And it's hard to sort of say, oh, but they're private emails, should I release them? No, you definitely should. Definitely, definitely should.
There's also a thing here which... So Dave McCarty was the Hugo administrator for at least one of the puppy years, and apparently quite happy to throw out slates by Chinese voters, but not happy to throw out slates by fascists. Don't know what to do with that information at all. Makes me very stressed out.
I want to be slightly careful about what I say here, but some American fans, including some fascists, are very litigious. So it's not impossible that Dave felt that if he had thrown out ballots from puppies would have sued, and that would be a worse outcome than not throwing out the ballots. I don't think he thought that random Chinese voters would be suing.
I think I would prefer that interpretation to many others.
But also, always look for interpretations that don't require people to be actively evil. I don't think very many people are actively evil. I think they just make bad decisions and they compound in a way that gets you into situations that are difficult to get out of.
That gets complicated when you're talking about stuff like dog whistles, and how I think there is a group of actors in every community that is very good at exploiting that inclination. And that's the problem when it comes to that. Liz, have you got anything on any of those scorching hot 2 week old? No, more than 2 week old takes.
Scorching hot month old takes. So yeah, I mean, I think I would fall on you don't throw out slate ballots. We came up with a way to basically make a fairer nomination system given the existence of slate ballots, and I think we use that. And if you basically use your ways of downranking stuff that's on slates and they're still at the top, then they're still at the top. So I'd say a couple of things. Yeah, so one take I've seen is that this was Western fandom in the form of Dave McCarty, Cat Jones and Diane Lacey doing this. It was all coming from the Western fandom's house and we were doing it to China. I think if you read these emails, which are all being sent when Dave is actually in China meeting with a lot of the team, it's clearly not just one side of the Hugo administration team. It is with his Chinese counterpart. They say they're going to have a discussion with his Chinese counterpart and so on. I think you can say that it was the Hugo administration fucking over all the voters, both Chinese and non-Chinese. But I don't think you can say it was entirely like Western fandom doing this of their own accord. We just don't have those emails, or those emails don't exist.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think the emails make it as clear as clear can be.
The emails make it very clear. Yeah. I mean, I will also say that I am, I don't know, weirdly slightly offended that it appears that whoever's vetting the podcast didn't bother to listen to any of the podcasts, because they're all down as no issues.
We've been criticising China. Why were we on the ballot? Boo.
But I don't think we were the only podcast to bring up issues around, you know, China and the Chengdu Worldcon.
Kat and Diane did not get down to podcasts. What happened was that Kat in her... What?
Yes, they did.
Yeah, they did.
Because it says no issues in Kat's column on the spreadsheet.
Oh.
Yep.
Oh.
Yeah. How dare you say there are no issues with our podcast? There are many issues.
Mostly harmless.
If we're going to say, if we're talking about people not reading the emails, then I am going to have to ding you for not reading the spreadsheet. We have no issues, guys. I certainly have no issues. Do you have no issues? You know, I don't think any of us have been to Tibet or Taiwan either, but, you know.
No. I'd love to.
Yeah, I'd love to go to Tibet.
I would very much like to go to Taiwan.
Also, to make it clear, free Tibet, Taiwan is an independent country.
Solidarity with Hong Kong. Anyway, so, but Ada Palmer's thing about self-censorship is relevant here because they did a much more thorough job than was probably required by their Chinese paymasters, right?
Yes, I think, I mean, I don't know, because as Liz says, we don't have an insight into the Chinese side of the committee anywhere near as good as the one we have into the Western side of the committee. But I would be astounded if this was like coming from the Chinese government. I suspect it's coming from the people in the Chinese half of the subcommittee who are aware of the sorts of things they need to be doing to make sure that they don't get in trouble. So I think it's exactly what Ada Palmer says in that article about, you know, you get good at the self-censorship.
Yeah, I mean, they're also presumably at this point thinking these are all the people we are going to invite on an, you know, expenses paid trip and potentially give them a big microphone if we give them an award to stand at the front and say whatever they like. And so they probably were thinking we want to exclude anyone who might use that microphone to say something extremely controversial.
For instance, the Octothorpe podcast. How dare they? I'm making it perhaps a little bit too much about us, so we should move on from that. There have been some great takes about this on the internet since we last recorded. I do want to specifically flag up James Bacon wrote in Journey Planet a scorching article about all of this, which is extremely angry in an extremely good way. And I will put a link to that issue of Journey Planet in the show notes. And I know that him and Chris have invited Paul Weimer to collaborate on an issue examining kind of where we go from here, which is very interesting. I've heard of multiple people who are working on various proposals for where we go from here. If you have any thoughts you're happy for us to broadcast and discuss on a future episode, please do let us know.
I got one more thing to say about the Hugos, and we're getting into the very dry side of things now, like we weren't before. But we talked before about how the Worldcon Intellectual Property Corporation is the thing that basically controls the Hugo trademarks, and they had various meetings from which we know about the censures for Dave McCarty, Ben Yellow and Chen Shi, and the resignation of Dave McCarty, and also the resignation of Kevin Stanley as chair, and went back down to being a regular board member. But they did release the minutes of these meetings, which don't tell you very much, except they do tell you the number of people who voted in favour and against the censures.
Oh, I did not see that. Well analysed, Liz.
So, I mean, I'm a bit confused because I was trying to count how many people were at the meeting, and I think some members of the board must have abstained or not voted in these votes, but it's not listed because it just lists in favour and against, so you don't know if people have abstained. But anyway, they voted by 10-3 to censure Dave McCarty, and then 8-5 to censure Dave McCarty, Ben Yellow and Chen Shi, and 8-6 to reprimand Kevin Stanley, which is interesting. So if you want to try and figure out who the 10-3, 8-5 and 8-6 were, well, have fun.
I mean, I think one of the things that comes out of all of this is that it wasn't just Dave. Like, until the Lacey emails came out, there was this narrative that maybe Dave had done it all. And it turns out everyone on that subcommittee is culpable, probably. And Ben Yellow was on that subcommittee. So, and I've had this image of Ben as a generally all right, nice bloke who's sometimes a bit vague. And now I've got a very different image of him in my head. And as we said earlier, Nicholas White has become the Hugo Han Solo.
I mean, when I think of definite rule-following, constitution-abiding role models from science fiction, I don't think Han Solo. But, I mean, I haven't read any of the Extended Universe novels, so I could be completely misrepresenting him.
I would recommend not doing.
Ange Rosin wrote to us, with, quote, a bit of a rant, which we are cutting a little bit, about the Hugos. She says she's seen the story develop, and right up to the report by Jason Sanford and Chris Barkley. Quite a lot of stuff has happened since then, but indeed we haven't been here. So she said she has two questions for Chris and Jason. Who is your intended audience for the report, and who asked you to write it? And she thinks she's answered it herself. Quote one, we wrote it for people like us. And two, if you were people like us, you would know. And I think that's actually quite a fair criticism of this report, that it's quite hard to parse if you're not already in the bubble.
I don't know how successful we are at this, but my aim with all of this discussion is to bring it to people who are not following it closely, because I think that is why we all wanted to start Oakthorpe, in part, was to let people who are not in the bubble into the bubble.
Just wanted to do a podcast.
I just wanted to make John do all the work.
Yeah.
We could have a podcast about board games, guys. It'd be way less stressful.
Oh, there's a thought. Where would we get listeners from?
I think we'd be able to become like the Oakthorpe Podcast Network, John, if you want to start up a little board game podcast of your own.
The thing is, there is one other podcast in the world called Oakthorpe, and it is a board game podcast.
Really?
Yeah, if we want to do a board gaming podcast, we need to pick a different punctuation mark. When we're trying to open the bubble up so that people can see what's inside, we are also, I think, trying to do it in a relatively measured way. I mean, I do know we disagree quite a lot.
I disagree with that.
I saw a YouTube video, which we haven't linked to, I don't think, a couple of YouTube videos about this, which essentially take Abigail Nussbaum's very considered report and make it hysterical, because that's how you get views on YouTube, is like going, oh, look, this is a shock and a scandal. And of course, this is a shock and a scandal. But I think it makes a lot of sense to try to talk about it in a measured way rather than actually I'm over here sharpening my pitchfork way.
Yeah, so Anand mentions that in her email using some spicy language. But, yes, I want to sharpen my pitchfork, but I want to do it slowly and menacingly rather than quickly and frantically. Is that good?
No.
But I think I agree with Ange here, which is that the report is important investigative journalism presented in a very odd way. I don't know. I found the report itself very hard to read.
It's kind of a mix of report and editorial in one. And I admit I was more into the reporting bit than the editorial bit.
Yeah, no, I like the detailed, stats.
Andrea's take on the report is that it's rambling, self-indulgent, one-sided and agenda-ridden, which I would not necessarily have used those exact words. But like, I think it's difficult to criticise it as a take.
I might say rambly, yeah.
So, Liz, Comestros Philapton released a very, very, very long set of stats and data that was like the one that you were talking about doing but didn't do, presumably because they had done.
No, I didn't do it because I was too lazy. So thank you to Comestros Philapton and Heather Owens-Jones for doing the thing I started, but they actually finished it. And because it is 48 pages long, I'm very glad I didn't do it. My only reservation about this is I just don't know how much of those figures in the Hugo stats are now basically made up. So it could be we've put a lot of time and effort into deep diving into something which is just built on a house of cards, but I'm glad it exists. And if anyone really wants a deep dive into how you can look at the Hugos and say, look, this is why these stats look funky, if you read it all, you definitely will understand EPH by the end of it as well. So give it a go.
Whee.
Given that human lifespans are short, do we really all need to understand EPH?
And I don't have a pick either. Sorry, forgot.
Liz, you're going first with your pick. Pick something. Pick something.
Right, hang on. Let me look at Goodreads and see what I read.
I've got a pick. I could go first, but...
Why are you making me go first then? You go first and let me look at what books I've read.
Okay. We went to see a indie Australian science fiction film called Monolith.
That sounds good.
It was good. It stars Lily Sullivan as a journalist who has been embroiled in a scandal of some description. The exact nature of the scandal is not really important. And she has resorted to podcasting to shore up her struggling career, which is very funny. And she starts looking at a story. So the podcast she's doing is this conspiracy theory podcast. So it is like very much a kind of a kooks podcast, if you will. And she gets an email from someone and she starts looking into the subject of their email. And it's all her on screen and then other people on the other end of phone lines. But the entire kind of thing is her in one set. I don't think it's perfect. I think there are some things it does which it could do better, but certainly it was really worth watching, really interesting, very creepy, very much gets the vibe it's going for. And I thought the ending, I really enjoyed how the ending kind of lampshades the futility of existence. Go watch it. If you can find it, I have no idea where you can watch it. I think you can rent it on places where you can rent movies, but I don't think it's streaming for free anywhere.
Blockbuster?
It got a theatrical release for a single week in the States, and so we went to see it in the cinema. But I don't think it's had a cinema release in the UK at all. And I think it has stopped playing in the States. So yeah, I think it's a rent it at home jobby.
I'm forced to conclude I'm going to have to start renting some movies to get the ones out, because a lot of them just never turn up on streaming and they are available for rental.
And also, with the amount that we watch movies at home, which is that we go to cinema quite a lot, so this might not apply to every listener, but I do sometimes wonder whether it would be cheaper for us just to rent movies where we want to rent them than it would be to try and hop around all the streaming services, because rentals are usually about £3, and subscribing to a streaming service for a month is more than that. So yeah, I'm beginning to wonder whether just, yeah, renting them when I want to watch them is the way forward. Bring back Blockbuster, that's what I say.
I have a pick, which is that I had arranged to have lunch with a friend in London on a Thursday when I was also going to the pub on Thursday evening, and that left me with 4 hours in the middle of the day. And I said, friends, what should I do with the 4 hours in the middle of the day? And one of the things that Alex Holden said, I think Alex is a listener, was why not go to Tom Hanks's Moonwalkers at the Lightroom Gallery in King's Cross. So Lightroom is a new gallery that is in something called Lewis Cubitt Square, which is kind of way north of King's Cross in that bit that used to be a dingy industrial site and is now what Stephen calls Google Town, a place where rich people hang out. And the gallery is a featureless box onto which things are projected onto the floor and walls. And this is a whole set of information about Apollo, which is not really going to be very new to most of the listeners of this podcast. And indeed, I knew most of the stuff that was contained in this already, and I'd seen most of the pictures before. Though not all of them, because apparently there are 10,000 pictures and they've all been remastered for this. And they used a very good camera, which you might not have realised, because a lot of the photographs were reproduced in not a very good way in the 60s and 70s. But they are, in fact, very good photos, even before they got remastered. This is kind of an answer to the question of, well, what happens when you want to do planetarium shows, but the old planetarium projector is now completely obsolete, so you project things onto your planetariums instead. But planetariums are expensive because they're dome-shaped, so why not just project things onto a cube? And there are a lot of exhibitions like this. We all really liked it. There were four of us, and we were all very moved and thought it was kind of delightful and thrilling. But I have some caveats. Which is the full ticket price is £25, which is absolutely outrageous. Holy goodness gracious. And we have art pass, so it was £12.50, which felt fine. And there are codes hanging around on the internet that will get it for £19, which is only ludicrously extortionate. £25 is too much for a one-room video projection. I was like, that's the same cost as Titanic Belfast. If you happen to be in Belfast next Easter for some reason, that's also £25, but has like multiple rooms of this sort and also many other things going on and an entire ship for you to look at, not the Titanic, and cost £25. So if you're in the mood for some ludicrously overpriced Apollo nostalgia, I thought it was pretty good. Tom Hanks turns out to be a giant space nerd, and part of the narration is his story of what it was like to be obsessed with Apollo as a child. So as certainly the four of us were obsessed with Apollo as children, and probably quite a lot of you listeners were as well. So for that sort of person, I think it probably hits the mark pretty well. Don't go at busy times, because reviews say it is oversold at busy times and people have to sit on the floor, which is no fun if you're the sort of age for people who were obsessed with Apollo as small children. I realise I have another little anecdote, which is I want to tell you a story about my husband, which is he was an Apollo obsessed child. And he had the prized possession of an Apollo 11 patch, which was like a really phenomenal souvenir if you lived in North Wales in 1969. And he got his mother to sew it onto his anorak, so that he could wear it to school. And so he had an anorak with an Apollo 11 patch on, and he hung it up in the cloakroom. And when he went back at break time, he discovered he had an anorak with a circle cut out. It's a sad story. I said, they have Apollo 11 patches if you'd like to buy one. And he said, it would just make me sad.
That is... I'm so sorry. That's awful.
It's one of these conflicting emotional anecdotes, yes. But what it was like to be a 10-year-old in 1969. Imagine what it was like to be a 10-year-old in 1969. So that's part of what I liked about the show, is it gives you some of that feeling.
I might have to look at going. It sounds intriguing. Liz, do you have a pick?
I mean, I don't have a pick, so...
Liz!
I don't want to pick something substantive. Sorry, I didn't think about it.
Well, pick your friendship with me. Listeners, you did not see the look on Liz's face when I suggested that.
Look, for picks, we like to pick things that listeners can at least experience. And, I mean, our listeners can be your friend, but they cannot experience a particular bond John and I have. A bond which, you know, we test on a frequent basis and become stronger.
And that was the Octothought podcast. And it's goodbye from me.
It would be goodbye from me if I wasn't laughing quite so hard.
And it's goodbye from me.
Sorry, is that another cultural reference you guys don't get?
I got it.
I was busy texting my wife.
Okay. So John wasn't listening and Liz got the reference. Okay.
Yes.
Yes. Do I need like a hand signal to show I've got your references or something?
You could laugh. I mean, I don't know. Maybe they're not funny.
See, now it's really awkward, isn't it? Moving swiftly on.
The theme music for this episode was Fanfare for Space by Kevin MacLeod and Compitech.com, used under a Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 license.
This podcast will end at the beep.
Beep.